You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
In literature, as in life, teenagers often turn to each other instead of to their parents in times of crisis. Although the high school classmates who are the heroes of Brewster, Mark Slaughter's latest novel, appear to have little in common, John Mosher and Ray Cappuccino are drawn into a deep friendship and come to depend on each other in part because their parents, who are suffering from traumas of their own, are unable to care for them. Brewster is Mr. Slaughter's third novel. Yeah. It's published by Norton. I'm very pleased that it brings him to our show. Hello.
Thank you for having me.
And Brewster is the town where the story is set, or should we say village?
It's town, village. It's the place that everybody drives through on the way to somewhere nicer.
How far north of New York City is it?
About an hour, give or take.
And you and your family live in Brewster?
Yeah, we've always been circling around Brewster. Now we actually own a house there, first house we've ever owned.
Did you imagine that your story, 16-year-old narrator John Mosher, lived in a house kind of like the one you live in now?
Exactly the house I'm living in now. Yeah, we were renting it when I was writing the book. And so I'd look out the window and I'd see, you know, Brewster going by. And that was, now I can't go through the town without seeing my guys sort of doing what they're doing in the fiction.
I understand the New York Times Book Review is going to be publishing a rave review of this coming Sunday. An article in Publishers Weekly said your writing here recalls the likes of Tobias Wolff and Raymond Carver.
That's bad company. High praise indeed, yeah.
You've set the book in the late 1960s with the Vietnam War, the assassinations of the Kennedys and Martin Luther King Jr., and the shootings of Kent State in the background. John is aware of them, but he and Ray are just too preoccupied with their own lives and problems to pay much attention.
Yeah, well, it's I mean, when you're 17, you have your preoccupations, right? And these are both kids who are fighting their own inner wars. So, you know, the small is not the right word. The inner war and the outer war sort of, you know, that they hear about from Walter Cronkite, those two are sort of brought together.
But is it coincidental that you've set your stories at a time when the Warsaw Pact countries invaded Czechoslovakia in response to the reforms of Prague Spring, because John Mosher's parents escaped from Czechoslovakia in 1948?
That's right. Well, there's a real connection there. It's I mean, I touch on it in the novel, and it was a big deal in my family, you know, because I remember my parents, you know, huddled by the TV when the tanks pulled into Prague. But it's, you know, like so many events, they seem, especially for a kid growing up in Brewster, they seem to be taking place somewhere else. They're in the distance. You're preoccupied with whatever's happening in your immediate life.
Even if your parents are Czechs, and that is definitely part of your cultural heritage.
Yeah, it is. Yeah, I grew up in this Czech, it's kind of a Czech ghetto in Queens, New York, Rigo Park. You know, my first language was Czech. I didn't speak English until I was six.
Really? So, yeah. Were there that many people that you could talk to in the neighborhood before you went to school?
Yeah, all our friends, their kids, they were all Czech. I remember going to the playground. Or at least I think I remember going to the playground and sort of wondering what the hell's going on.
Although you have changed the heritage of his family, they're Germans, aren't they?
Yeah,
they escaped the Holocaust.
Yeah, they they're German Jews who sort of escaped, you know, in the nick of time, sort of through the closing door, and they carry that with them, which is part of the deep background of the book.
You've depicted late 1960s Brewster as a working class village, a bit down on its luck. Did you try to create an accurate picture of what Brewster was like at the time, or have you come up with a kind of a fictional version?
No, I think it's pretty close. I hope it's pretty close. There's this, you know, this is my first American book. It's the first time I've sort of given up wrestling with sort of the ghosts of my parents' times and, you know, the world they grew up in. And the thing about Brewster living in it now is that you walk out and you hear this beautiful sort of New York area vernacular. This, you know, it's profane, it's poetic, it seems to me. And so I built a lot of that, or tried to build a lot of that into the novel. You try to listen. You open your ears and you just listen to how people speak, and it's beautiful.
Even today, Brewster, is it still a mainly blue-collar village?
Well, now I call it Little Quito now because it's mostly Ecuadorian, but it's going through another one of its phases. It's still Italian-American overall. You ask some guy where something is in a store, and he'll say, "It's the only thing I know where it is in the store," which is a great sentence, mm-hmm. right? It doesn't make sense. Grammatically, it's a Picasso, but it's a beautiful sentence. So it's Italian-American, it's Irish-American, it's now it's Ecuadorian, Guatemalan, it's America.
And it sounds to me like you feel that in, that the way they speak enriches the language, and it also helps a writer to do things that you might not do otherwise.
Oh, it's been a liberation for me. It's a homecoming. It's it's the first time I've, like I said, allowed myself to listen. I was born and raised in this country, but I was always, as I said, dealing with my parents' stories, and lost my father the day after this book was written. And I think it's, you know, it's appropriate in a way. It's time to write my own story.
Well, this is your third novel, but it's your eighth book overall.
Yeah, thereabouts. Yeah, something like that. Yeah, sixth, I think, actually.
In a number of short stories and essays, you've expressed concern about the changes that are being brought about by technology. Did you choose to set your novel in 1968 in part because that was well before the advent of smartphones and computers and laptops?
Yeah, maybe, you know, on some subliminal level. I think I like the background of the 60s because revolution was in the air, you know, and, you know, it's like that Bob Dylan song, you better start swimming or or you'll sink like a stone. I could have used that as an epigraph for the novel, for my guys. So I like the interplay between, as I said, sort of the small inner war taking place in these boys' families and the larger sort of landscape of revolution, change, rebellion, resistance happening around them.
And not just in their families, in the weather as well. Your story makes the winters there seem quite uninviting and bleak. Is there something about its location that makes Brewster especially harsh during the winter months?
I'm not particularly. I think
is it just how John remembers it?
It's just, I think, how he remembers it. It's, you know, when you're a working class kid, you know, you're not always ready. You're wearing whatever layers of sweatshirts and t-shirts you can get together. You're cold. I remember being cold as a kid a lot. Maybe because I was too, you know, dumb to remember my gloves or something. But, you know, we were always walking everywhere too. That's the other thing. We didn't have cars, so you walked for miles wherever you had to go. So we froze a lot. So you tend to remember the winter as being a lot longer than the summer could ever be.
My guest is Mark Sloka, Slouka. His latest book is his third novel called Brewster. It's published by Norton. Would you read a bit for us?
Oh, yeah. It'd be a pleasure.
Because one of the pleasures of this book is just how beautiful the prose is.
Well, this is the beginning is always a good place to begin. So I figured I'd
begin. Well, you won't confuse anybody.
Exactly. So this is the beginning of Brewster. The first time I saw him fight was right in front of the school. Winter. It was before I knew him. I noticed him walking across the parking lot, that long coat, his hair tossing around in the wind, with some guy I'd never seen before following 20 feet behind and two others fanned back like wings on a jet. It was the way the three of them were walking, tight, fast, closing quickly. That and the fact that instead of speeding up, he seemed to be deliberately slowing down, one hand in his pocket, the other still bringing the cigarette to his mouth, his head at that too-late angle I didn't know yet. And then he turned as if to tie his shoe, the hair blowing over his face, tossed the butt and tackled the guy with such fury, low, head down, that the two of them were actually airborne before they crashed into the icy slush. And then one of the others was being pulled off his back and he'd shaken free and was walking away, ignoring the yelling, the threats, the small crowd gathered around the figure still lying on the ground. I watched him cut between the cars, walking easy, running a lazy finger along a fin, tapping a side-view mirror. At the edge of the parking lot, he stopped, though there wasn't any traffic. Like nothing had happened, like there was nothing behind him. And I saw his shoulders hunch and his head bend forward, and realized he was lighting up.
Now, this is an unlikely friendship between these two kids. John is your narrator, is a quiet loner, mm-hmm. seems to be a capable student, although he isn't well-liked by his parents. And then you have, I mean, by his teachers. Yeah. And then you have Ray, who's rebellious, one of the cool kids in school, the kid who is very likely to fight any time he's challenged.
Yeah, Ray Capicciano, he's the brawler. He's a tough kid. He's one of these kids who seems like he came out of the womb sort of able to handle himself. I had a friend a lot like Ray who actually had a little brother named Gene, like Ray in the book does. I was 12 years younger than him, and my Ray would have just laid down on the tracks for this kid. And I remember being impressed with that, you know, when I was 14, that kind of love. John Mosier is, he's a, He's a damaged kid in a lot of ways. They both are, and that's why.
Why isn't he liked by his teachers and his fellow students?
He's sullen. He has a chip on his shoulder. He's introverted. He's kind of bookish. He's way too smart in some ways.
And he's also carrying a heavy load on his shoulders. Mm-hmm. His parents kind of blame him for his brother's death.
Yeah. Well, when he's 4 years old, his brother, who's five at the time, goes out to the street and finds a lamp and comes back to his room, plugs it in, and dies. It's one of those things, as John says. And his mother is never able to get over it and never really forgives John for not having said something. She feels he could have said something. A four-year-old.
When your parents do that to you, even though you realize that's really irrational, you still feel guilty.
Yeah. I mean, that's what the novel's about, really. It's about the wages of grief and of guilt and the shot at redemption that we may occasionally be offered.
I mentioned that you have expressed concerns about the changes being brought about by technology. Is it true that you don't own a cell phone and that you write at least during the warmer months and in a small shack in the woods that has no electricity?
Yeah, they're both true. I don't know if that speaks well for me or not, but yeah, I'm probably the last man standing who doesn't have a cell phone. I need to keep what Thoreau called a wide margin on his life. I'd like that.
So you write everything out in longhand?
Actually, not entirely. No, I do write longhand. I love the feeling of a pen on paper. But for revising, for the big bulk work, I use a word processor too. So I've bent
a word processor.
Yeah.
Oh,
okay.
Yeah. Well, that's almost dinosaur technology. Are you already working on another project? Short stories, nonfiction.
I've always been very suspicious of sequels because I think sometimes they're a real easy answer. They're a cop-out. But I have to admit that I don't think John Mosher is done with me. In the book that I'm writing now, he's 58. Same man, just a lot older.
Well, I've spoken to a number of writers about what happens to characters after they finish a book. And some of them say, well, once I'm finished, they're gone. And others say, well, their voice still continues to talk to me. And you think about somebody like John Updike, who returned to Rabbit three times, I guess, or twice after the first book, because it was he was somebody who he could speak through.
Yeah. Well, you know them, and you miss them when they're gone. I mean, I've had dreams about characters I wrote novels about, and when the novel was done, I had that character come to me, you know, and speak to me in a dream. That sounds fruity, but it's true.
So you have John much older.
He's 58. He's living in Arizona with his wife Alice.
And what's happened to Ray?
Ray's gone. Ray's gone. He's not in the book.
So. My great thanks to you for having been here, Mark Slauka. His latest book is Brewster. It is published by Norton. And look for that incredible review in the Sunday Times Book Review. But every word of it is true.
Oh, thank you so much. I'd like to believe it.